It's time for Let's Talk Legal with your host, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins from the law firm of Harvell & Collins. If you've got a legal question, they can give you the answer. Call now, 1-800-818-2255, and let's talk legal.
And let's talk legal with Harvell & Collins, attorneys at law, on the web at harvellandcollins.com, and joining us in the studio this morning. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning, Ben.
Good morning, Ben.
And where did we leave off last week?
Well, we were talking about asset protection last week, Ben, mainly in the context of nursing home care, long-term care situations. Cecil and I spoke a little bit in general regarding protecting the home and some other assets, and just gave an overview of the process and how important it is to, you know, sit down and have a plan with regard to protection of assets so we don't, you know, possibly lose assets that otherwise the law allows us to protect.
Right, right.
So today I think we'll get into a little bit more detail with regard to that. I think we'll answer some questions that, you know, we normally end up hearing in our office from our clients or prospective clients.
If you have questions too, you can call in. Our local numbers are 247-7282 or Anonzo 353-4674.
One of the most common questions, Ben, is, well, gosh, you know, I've waited too long. Isn't there a look back period? And for many years, the look back period was 3 years or 36 months. It has recently changed, Ben, to 5 years or 60 months. And so there is a look back period. And so the sooner one does this planning, the better we're going to be. However, for those of you that are listening that are dealing with this issue now or think you're going to be dealing with it in the next year or so, and yet, you know, cannot wait 5 years, there are certain avenues that we can take that will help you with that look back period. Now, we can't, you know, we don't hold the magic bullet to every issue,
right?
Of course, right. But we do apply the law as aggressively as we can for certain clients under certain situations. We are able to help them even though we are within that 5 year look back period. So don't allow that to be, a complete bar to you coming in having a consultation with a good lawyer about, protecting the assets of mom or dad, grandmother, granddaddy, aunt, uncle, whatever the situation might be.
Because you may still qualify for some aid. I mean, you might be surprised, right?
Absolutely. Well, it's like we talked about last week. I mean, you know, you really don't know exactly what is available as far as planning techniques and as far as protecting your assets until you sit down with someone who knows. It's a bad idea to, you know, just take the information off the street or what your next door neighbor told you or your, you know, even maybe your accountant or someone who kind of maybe dabbles or hears things about it. It's better off to deal with someone who not only does the planning on a regular basis, goes to the continuing education seminars at the North Carolina Bar Association and learns about, you know, all the ins and outs of this, you know, keeps his ear to the ground on any changes or anything that might change, and the person who is going to see you through the Medicaid application and has to be responsible for that application in the event that the planning is done and we do have to, in fact, apply. That's the person you need to be talking with.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Now, Ben, more specifically, we're going to begin working with the client and the paralegals working with the client in kind of pinning down, if you will, the real estate assets, which are land and or home, you know, or condominium, anything having to do with a real estate holding. And then the other side of the coin, the personal property holdings, the stocks, the bonds, the CDs, the money market account, any life insurance policies that have cash value that could be cashed in. All of those are going to fall within the category of personal property. And of course, we're going to divide those. We're going to look at that. We're going to look at those distinct and separate, and we're going to begin to protect the real estate holdings initially and do what we can to put those into various types of trust, again, depending on the facts of the file, so that they are protected. As to the personal property, it's important for our listeners to understand that it doesn't matter whether the IRA is in granddad's name or the CD is in grandmother's name, or that, you know, grandmother has, you know, a couple of hundred thousand and granddaddy has, you know, 25,000. Medicaid is going to look at the household personal property. Mm-hmm. They're going to add it all together, no matter whose name it happens to be in. Mm-hmm. For instance, even life insurance, maybe that's a policy on dad, okay? Well, maybe it has $50,000 of cash value. Just because the policy is owned by dad and is on his life, he's the insured, does not mean that it's not included in the formula, because after all, the idea here is that, you know, the husband and wife, as a couple, do have access to all of this household liquidity, no matter whose name it happens to be in. Another caveat with this, and I've had a couple of these lately, where, you know, there's a lot of remarrying going on, Ken.
Yeah, right. I was just getting ready to ask about that specific thing in our
elder population.
Right.
And of course, it's just wonderful to be involved and see them come in after having lost a spouse for whatever reason and now finding someone else to spend their life with. But you have to stop a bit. Not that one is not going to get married because of this issue, but at least go into the marriage knowing that, you know, if one party has significant assets and the other does not.
Mm-hmm.
If the to-be husband mm-hmm. has got, you know, significant assets and the to-be wife has got, you know, a smaller number of assets or vice versa, then we've got to keep in mind that for Medicaid planning, those assets are going to be looked at cumulatively. They're going to be put together.
Even if something's brought in from before the marriage.
Absolutely. Right. And even if there is a prenuptial
agreement. It is not marital property.
Right.
By virtue of the fact that right. You had it before you got married.
Right, right. Right. You're talking what we always say, Ken, I appreciate you using the lingo. You're talking, of course, you know, divorce language.
Yes.
Okay? And, of course, we haven't changed divorce language. I mean, yes, for divorce purposes, there might be marital property and separate property. There's also tax language, by the way.
Yeah.
Okay? Mm-hmm. And that language still applies as to, let's say an asset is sold in the capital gain. Where does that apply? Is there a step up in basis? All of those issues are tax language, issues. But right now, we're talking Medicaid language. And Medicaid language is that we don't care whether it's separate or marital. We don't care where the capital gain might apply or who has a step up in basis. Those assets, because of a marriage and the significance of a marriage in the state of North Carolina, therefore those assets are available to both the husband and the wife, no matter whose name they happen to be in, and no matter And by the way, a prenuptial cannot change that.
Okay. Right.
That is a
but
real.
But you could.
Yes.
Fix that. The property that belongs to hubby from
somewhere
his
else.
Parents left to him could be put in a trust or something, perhaps, that would keep it out of Medicare?
You mean
Medicaid.
Medicaid, yeah. Excuse me.
I mean, there are planning techniques that we use, of course, mm-hmm. to protect those personal assets.
But yeah, Cecil, you alluded, though, to something. The fastest growing segment of the population that is living together and not being married is elderly.
That's correct. And a lot of them, that is absolutely correct, Ben. I mm-hmm. mean, I am just astonished at how many elder folks come in to see our Wes and myself, and they either are not married and have been living together for a long time, or now maybe after living together, they decide to get married. And they are very aware of all of these issues. Mm-hmm. Survivorship benefits for pension. Survivorship benefits as to Social Security issues.
Right.
But yet they have children from previous marriages. And so what has to happen here is that we have to get our language straight.
Mm-hmm.
Are we talking about estate planning and assets going back to their own respective children? Are we talking about tax planning? Are we talking about, well, we get married and then maybe we don't get along and we've got some divorce planning? Or are we talking Medicaid planning? And, of course, you know, that's why maybe our listeners are beginning to hear that, hey, you know.
I need to have somebody who knows the language.
Yeah, there's a lot of things that we lawyers have to think about.
Right.
And what folks want more than anything else is they don't want to be surprised.
Yeah, clarity.
Clarity.
What they want. Yeah,
correct.
We're going to talk more about that. See if we can clear it up. And also, if you have questions, you can call us too at 800-818-2255, 247-7282, 353-4674. More to come in a moment. Welcome back. And again, we're with Harvell and Collins, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins, online at harvellandcollins.com, and talking about the complications of language involved here when we're talking about Medicaid.
Right. We'll just give one more, hopefully maybe clean example, and then we'll move on. But all the time, Wes and I are getting, but I understand I can give $13,000 away a year.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you absolutely can, but what you're talking is tax language there. You're talking about your gift tax exclusion per donee in every calendar year. That's tax language. Medicaid doesn't allow you to give $13,000 away a year.
Right.
That's Medicaid language.
Right. So, you know, you talk about protecting these assets. It just occurred to me. Is it easier, say you have somebody, a couple, and they've got a house, and they're older, and they've maybe paid off their house, but they also have their only other income, or their only income is coming from Social Security and maybe a retirement program or an annuity. Is it easier to protect real property than it is some of those other income streams?
No question. It's easier to protect the real property. And that's what we always do first. And there's several reasons why we do that first. The law allows us to do that. We can do that in a way where there is no look back period.
Mm-hmm.
We can do that in a way where there's zero tax consequences for the client. And we can do that in a way where we're not just giving the property to the kids and then potentially creating a tax liability and tainting the property with all the twists and turns of the kids' lives, such as a divorce or a car accident or whatever else, a judgment against one of the children for not paying a credit card bill. You know, we don't want to expose our property to those. So we can, to those type of situations. So we can protect all real estate, under the law in a way that really does not adversely affect our client at all.
Mm-hmm.
So we look at the real property first. Now, another reason we look at the real property first, and another reason that folks like to do planning well in advance of a possible stay in a care facility is because, you know, Cecil and I know the law in and out right now with regard to this, but we don't have a crystal ball. We don't know if things are going to change in the future as it relates to being able to protect assets in the way the law allows us to now.
Mm-hmm.
But our experience is that in, you know, practicing in this area for 15 or so years, that if you have done the planning, if you put that in place, if the law changes, you're grandfathered in.
Mm-hmm.
There's yet to be a situation with the Medicaid law changes in our years of practice in this area where the law did not recognize that there may have been some planning done before and you're allowed to grandfather it in. So a lot of folks want to do the planning in advance because the law allows you to do it right now.
Right, right.
And we'd really like to focus on that real estate now because we have a very clean way under the law to allow us to do that. As far as personal property goes, a lot of things we can do to protect personal property. But we're really not doing a lot of moving of personal property right now.
Mm-hmm.
Unless the individual is needing to go into the care facility right now.
I see. See, so that becomes a more of a time factor.
It does. Well, what's most important with regard to the personal property, in my opinion, is that we have the proper power of attorney in place and we have the trust set up with the real estate so that we're ready. We have a plan in place. So in the event that the mother, father, husband, wife, grandmother, grandfather, whoever it might be, ends up having to go into a care facility, we're not then having to scurry around and try to pick all the pieces out to figure out what we're going to do to protect what we have.
Mm-hmm.
We have a plan in place. And we know exactly what we have, and we have the power of attorney in place and the trust in place, and then we look at the personal property at that point in time and plan accordingly.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the main goals that we're trying to achieve, of course, especially with a, well, with a husband and wife, would be that, you know, we could have a situation, and we see this quite often, where we have one spouse who is ill, has to go into the care facility, and then there's a failure to plan, and the other spouse far outlives the one who goes into the care facility.
Hmm.
Because there was a failure to plan, the community spouse, the surviving spouse, runs out of assets, or doesn't doesn't have enough to keep up with, you know, the mortgage or the rent, if that's the case, the monthly expenses, those type things. So we see that fairly often, but not when we do planning ahead of the situation.
It makes for all the reason why you want to go ahead and call and make that appointment and get those plans started. You know, as you're talking about these things, I'm thinking of some various examples and various people that I know. And often they have followed the street sense. So if somebody has done something like deeded a property over, can you go back
Absolutely.
And fix
something? Absolutely. Yeah. And another one is, you know, giving the liquidity away.
Right.
You know, they go ahead and give, you know, $50,000 to each child.
Right.
And of course, you know, in all fairness, Ben, I mean, you know, everything that you, it's not that it's illegal to give $50,000 to every child. Come on. I mean, if that's what a parent wants to do, they're entitled to do that. There might be some consequences to that. No illegal consequences, but
tax
if you
want
tax or otherwise, you know, other things can happen, as we always talk about on this program. When you title your property in your children's names, the property is now subject to the twists and turns of the child's life, such as a divorce or credit or anything else. But to get back on point again, if you've done these things, okay, transferred the house onto the children, done that 2 or 3 years ago, given them each amount of money, this doesn't mean that we can't mold the clay, and many times fix those issues, okay, you know, cure those kind of, if you will, defective kind of things that were done, okay?
Right.
We have to be upfront about it. We have to fully disclose it and show it to the Medicaid planning folks.
Yes.
But the bottom line is that most of the time we're able to fix those problems.
You know, in that same vein, another question that we get quite often, Ben, is that, you know, folks come in, they say, well, I put my son's name on my account 5 years ago, so I think I'm okay on that one, or my daughter's name or whatever.
Right.
That makes no difference whatsoever.
Yeah.
Because if you just put the name on the account, well, it's probably a joint account. You still have access to it. Right. So Medicaid counts the entire account.
Right.
And we never recommend putting children's names on accounts, well, really in any context, if we're talking about Medicaid or just estate planning, because oftentimes we find that, you know, that is, of course, exposing your money, your account, to the twists and turns of your child's life, number one. Number two, is that really what you want to do?
Yeah.
If your will says I leave everything equally to my four kids, and the majority of your liquid estate is in this one account, but it's joint with this one child, then it goes to the one child. Cecil and I have talked about that over and over again. I was in a continuing legal education seminar last night or last week with the North Carolina Bar Association. The attorney speaking was going on and on and on about don't do this. This is a problem. This creates litigation for the family.
It really does.
Don't do it.
All right. And we'll have more to come in just a moment here on Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins. Remember to go to the website, harvellandcollins.com, to find out lots of great information, listen to past shows, and you can call for an appointment at 252-726-9. And we'll have more in a moment. Welcome back. Again, we're talking with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins about estate planning and also about Medicaid planning in particular here. Now, is this for estates of a particular size that do Medicaid planning, or do you see it in all size estates?
I think the circumstances of the particular situation are very important. I mean, if we're talking about someone, Ben, who is, you know, let's say, in their 50s, early 50s, and has been diagnosed with an Alzheimer's, Well, yeah, we might be looking at doing some planning with regard to, you know, maybe a little bit larger estate mm-hmm. than we would with someone who's maybe in their 70s and is just, or 80s or having, you know, a dementia diagnosis or having, you know, just some, you know, physical issues or whatever.
Right.
So, but yes, there is. I mean, and there's not really, I think a fine, there's not a distinct line with regard to that. Mm-hmm. We have to look at the circumstances in any particular file to make that determination. But no, we're not talking about, you know, folks with $2 million in a stock account. You know,
right.
That's, they usually can make, you know, plenty of income in order to offset the expenses.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we are, I'd say our average client is, you know, has, with regard to the Medicaid situation, maybe has real estate, maybe another piece of property, and certainly maybe several hundred thousand dollars, mm-hmm. you know, of assets, husband and wife.
Right.
We certainly plan for those type of folks, but it's very much based on the circumstances in each file.
There you go. That's important to know, I think, because a lot of people, as we talk about estate plannings, again, one of the first things you talk about is how it's not just for people with column houses. I mean, it's for anybody, any,
you know, husband, it really is
couple.
Because some of the smaller estates, mm-hmm. If you will, whatever small means, again, lawyer, we're not in the judgment business, you know,
right.
Ben.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever you have, what I find the common is whether it's a large or whether it's small, whatever those words might mean. It's important,
mm-hmm.
Very important to that particular client. And whatever they happen to have, they want to protect it, and they want to see that it is efficiently passed to their children without excessive delay and without excessive cost, and, of course, in larger files, without excessive tax. So there's a lot of common ground out there. Notwithstanding, you know, maybe the size of the asset base.
Right. The Medicaid rules are also interesting when we look at the numbers, the amounts that the legislators and those who have put together the Medicaid laws and rules have used. For
mm-hmm.
example, when we're talking about signing what's called an intent to return home, which
right.
is something we normally don't do, but you can do it to make the home a non-countable asset, but then it's subject to a lien. That's very complicated. But you can't do that for property that's worth over $500,000 on the tax books.
Mm-hmm.
So that tells me that Medicaid recognizes
mm-hmm.
that folks who have real property, the home, that's worth $500 or less, may very well be someone who is receiving Medicaid benefits. So that's,
right.
that's one indication. Another one is under the Community Spouse Resource Allowance. That's very complicated as well. Maybe we can talk about it next week. But that number is the community spouse, healthy spouse, gets to keep a little over $100,000 if planning is done correctly.
All right. Again, we can talk more about that next week, and you can talk about it when you make that appointment with Harvell and Collins, Attorneys at Law, 252-726-9050.